Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Politics can be a tough business. There are endless funds to raise and hearts and minds to win in pursuit of votes, opponents to size up and then out-strategize, and of course, punishing hours and often petty squabbles among those with whom one is supposed to cooperate to get things done. To thrive in such a business, one needs a sharp mind, a thick skin, a great sense of humor, and an abiding faith that all the nonsense is worth it, if it allows principled, dedicated people to occupy positions of leadership. David Axelrod has a boundless supply of such optimism, seasoned by an early career in political journalism and decades of work as a consultant to dozens of candidates for office, most notably as former senior advisor to President Obama and senior strategist for his election and re-election campaign and a longtime political consultant. In 2012, Axelrod founded the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of the new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's endowed to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Good to be here.
You open the book with a charming story of yourself as a five-year-old being taken by your babysitter to see then-candidate John F. Kennedy speak in your neighborhood. What do you, like, what are the sensory memories you have of that day?
Oh, you know, it says something about the experience that all these years later, it is still so clear in my mind. What happened was my mother was at work. This woman, Jessie Berry, who took care of me when I was young, an African-American woman, you know, came up from the South, no formal education, lots of wisdom, and really raised me. She heard JFK was coming to Stuyvesant Town, this housing development where I was growing up. And she thought I should see it, and she took me out and put me on top of a mailbox. And what I remember is 20th Street, which is this huge boulevard that's always filled with traffic. Now it was filled with people, and there were no cars, and everybody was staring at this rostrum, and this very charismatic young man with red hair jumped up on this rostrum and started speaking, and his voice was booming off of the buildings. And I was five. I didn't know exactly what he was saying, but I got the gist that it was really, really important, and everybody was paying rapt attention to him. And, you know, it really is sort of a seminal event in my life. It was the thing that got me really interested, and I started following him and all things about him and politics, watching it on TV. And he was the first television president. So as a young kid, you know, I watched the news. Sadly, I watched all the coverage after he was assassinated. And what I took away from it and what I subsequently learned about politics that I still believe is that somehow this is the way we get a chance to steer the course of our own history, that we need, you know, that we can influence our destiny. He talked in that day. I went back years later to look at the speech about the fact that he wasn't running on the platform that said if you elect him, everything would be good. He said being an American citizen in the 1960s was a hazardous occupation and filled with both challenge and hope. And he said, we'll decide which path we take. And that really that appeals to me, this notion that we actually have some ability to determine the path we take. And that's what politics at its core should be all about.
It's such a great origin story. I was struck by wondering, like, what if you had been taken to see candidate Nixon in that same year?
Yeah. Well, the question is, would Jesse have thought that was a worthwhile experience? I think that she took me in part because she had lived a very hard life, and she had some hope that this guy could make a difference. I think that's why she thought it was important. And, you know, to me, I always think back to the fact that she started me off on this, put me on that mailbox, and I ended up working for the first African-American president of the United States. You know, she came up from South Carolina at a time when people were dying just for the opportunity to vote. So in a sense, that speaks to our ability to make progress as a country.
How much discussion was there on the campaign team and then even within the White House about the extent to which race would really be an issue that was thoroughly addressed by the Obama White House?
Well, during the campaign, we didn't address it for a long time because it was obvious. I mean, the fact that he was the first viable African-American candidate for president was lost on no one. And what we didn't want to do was make that the entire definition of his candidacy. So we were self-conscious about not emphasizing that aspect of his candidacy. You know, in a sense, we talked about change, and the change that he would represent just by being elected was obvious to everyone. We had to take it on when Reverend Wright burst onto the scene as an issue. And it was really one of the key moments in the whole campaign because it was a real threat to the campaign and the candidacy when this when his pastor or his former pastor now surfaced in little tidbits that were taken from sermons that were really incendiary and created the image of a guy who was you know quite radical and edgy and. Who the president identified as, you know, someone who was an influence on his life. That was when he said, look, we've got to address, I want to address race and put Reverend Wright in context of the larger issue of race in America. It was an incredible 4 days because he decided this on a Friday night when after the story broke and said he wanted to give this speech no later than Tuesday morning. I write about this in the book. And he was campaigning every day, and we said, well, he said, I got to write this speech. I said, when are you going to write this speech? He wrote about half of it on a Sunday night. The speech was on a Tuesday morning. Before we left for Pennsylvania to campaign, we set the speech up for the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And then the night before the speech, he wrote the other half and finished it at like 2 or 3 in the morning. I remember getting the speech and reading it. And I emailed him back, and I said, this is why you should be president, because he was under enormous pressure, no sleep, and he wrote this cogent, powerful, moving speech, probably the best any politician's ever given on the issue of race in America. But in the presidency as well, you know, we were so consumed by so many things when we got there. And I was there the first 2 years, an epic economic crisis, two wars. The president took on the health care crisis that, you know, we didn't spend a whole lot of time addressing the issue of race.
It's always striking to me, at least in the age of television, when we can observe these things, the extent to which people are physically aged by being president.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about a sort of work day for a president and the role that staffers play in trying to protect that time and that energy?
Yeah, it's hard to really to protect a president because the issues come one after another serially. And as the president always said, only the impossible ones get to him. If it can be solved somewhere else, it'll be solved somewhere else. And so, you know, I think of a particular day I wrote about in my book when he was dealing with the what to do about the American auto industry. This was early in his term. And it was clear that General Motors and Chrysler were on the verge of collapse. And if the government didn't intervene, they would collapse. There was tremendous public opposition to that. We had he had an auto task force we met with in the morning. Before he even met with that auto task force, he had had a long meeting with his national security people about a potential missile launch from North Korea. And then after, and we had 45 minutes, he said, I'm not going to decide the future of the American auto industry in 45 minutes. We're going to meet at the end of the day. And then he went on to a series of meetings on Afghanistan, on Iraq. He had a town hall meeting on the economy. And that's the way every day went. Then we had a couple-hour meeting on the auto industry in which he decided to move forward. It was a very dramatic meeting and a fateful decision. I went back to my office and slumped in my chair, and the phone rang. It was Rahm Emanuel, our chief of staff, and he said, get in here. Fargo's underwater. Flood in Fargo. And that was not that unusual a day. I mean, not every day has decisions of that magnitude, but every day is filled with challenges, some you anticipate and some you can't. So, you know, when he's earned every one of those gray hairs, you know, and every president does. One thing, Chris, that I learned very quickly serving in the White House was that I have great respect for anybody who's ever sat in that chair, whether I agree with them or not. The pressures, the unrelenting pressures of that job are just crushing. And it takes extraordinary people to want to do it and to do it and to do it. And it takes it, and it is a sacrifice. And nobody wants to, you know, you don't, it's an honor and a privilege, obviously. So, and no one wants to say, well, being president is a sacrifice. It's a huge sacrifice, you know, and I think anybody who does it deserves our respect.
Reading your book and a lot of other political memoirs and biographies, it's pretty clear that the people who are working in supportive positions like yours are no less passionate about the issues, about the importance of politics. What separates the people who actually get out there and run from the people who decide that their best role is to support the candidates they believe in?
Well, I think it takes a certain amount of courage to get out there and run and expose yourself to the judgment of people in a way that candidates do. Some people are driven by that. You know, I always say the world of candidates divides into two categories. The one more numerous category of people who run for public office because they want to be something. And then there's the smaller, more admirable category of people who run for public office because they want to do something. And, you know, there's some overlap and so on, but that's basically the way it is. For that larger category, you know, there's often a need to have the approbation that comes along with serving in public office, and that drives them. In the smaller category, people see politics as a calling and an ability, an opportunity to impact your community, the country, the world in some way, in a positive way, beyond your own aggrandizement. But it, in either case, it is, I think, a courageous thing to stand up in front of your neighbors, whether it's your neighbors in a community or your neighbors in a country, and ask them to judge you in the way that candidates are judged.
President Obama has been criticized at times, including by people who support the work that he has done and the things that he believes in, for not really getting into the game of politics to the extent, someone like Bill Clinton certainly loved the policy, but boy, he loved the game.
Right.
Was this a concern for you at various points because you have to play the game a little bit, particularly with people who are sitting in Congress that might oppose legislation that he really wanted?
Well, first of all, I think we have to separate out what we mean by politics, because there are elements of politics, campaigning, meeting everyday people, that completely energizes him. And when I went out on the road with him, he was always happy when he was able to mix with folks, go into diners, go into taverns, go into veterans halls, go into town squares and meet with people. And now, does he love the politics of Washington? Not all the time. No, not terribly much. And I believe everybody's strength is their weakness. To me, one of his towering strengths is that he believes that there are more important things even than winning elections. And I've seen him risk his own political hide to run for office. To get things done. And I admire that. But the flip side of that is most people in Washington think elections are the most important thing. And he hasn't always related well to those politicians. He tends to feel like they should do their meet their responsibility and take the political consequences. And there's a disconnect in that as some of the time.
We're speaking this hour with David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama and author of the new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to longtime political consultant David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama and senior strategist for his election and reelection campaigns. He founded the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago in 2012, and he has just published a new memoir called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. David Axelrod is in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. What did it feel like the night that the president was elected president?
Well, it was obviously an extraordinary experience. But the thing that I took away from, and I was moved by the scenes that I saw, not just across the country, but across the world. I mean, the kind of excitement that his election generated, and I don't think it was all about him. It was about what it said about America, that this improbable thing could have happened. It was an affirmation of our best self, that he could overcome historic obstacles and become president of the United States. But the thing that I remember most is walking into his suite after the returns were in at the hotel where he was waiting before we went over to Grant Park, and how much I saw him change in this sort of in a way that I hadn't the sobriety that I saw, this sense that, you know, rather than hooping and hollering and slapping fives and fist pumping and so on, what I found was a guy who seemed to be absorbing the fact that these responsibilities were now his. And and it may be that way in every time a president gets elected, but it's as if the power of the presidency was now around him, surrounding him, and the responsibilities of the presidency you could almost see on his face. And that's what I'll remember. And I felt that when we were in the park. You know, it was a tearful, joyful experience. And I looked in the audience and I saw people's faces and holding their American flags. It was just an incredible experience. But I also just remember that sobriety. Even in his remarks, it was, okay, the campaign's over and now the responsibilities are his. And as a friend, I had, you know, mixed feelings about that because I knew how difficult those challenges would be.
This might seem like a strange question to you, but is it strange when you cross that point at which you realize you will never call your friend by his first name again?
Not a strange question. And it is, you know, it is an odd thing because I'd known him since he was a returning law student from Harvard University. But I think it goes along with what I was saying before. You know, there is this unspoken thing that happens when a president becomes president, and he assumes that office, and that office kind of assumes him. And, you know, so there is this respect that you show him and the office. And it is a really odd thing. And I must tell you that, and I wrote about this, I had misgivings about going to Washington. I've always sort of avoided Washington as a reporter and as a consultant, because I liked living in Chicago, first of all, and my family was there, but also because I felt I was more in touch with what was going on in the country than in Washington, which is kind of a pathological town. I mean, it's a town that's very stuck on itself, very much absorbed by who's up and who's down and what's in the Daily Gallup poll and what's in the Politico and so on. And I, you know, it was an environment I wasn't all that eager to immerse myself in. And then but what I told him also was I had structured my whole life as a reporter and as a consultant in such a way that I could tell anybody to, and for purposes of public radio, I'll say to jump in a lake. Mm-hmm. And you can't say that to the president of the United States. And he said, well, he said, you really can't. He said, but here are the reasons why you should come. And he made a case for why I should come, compelling. And at the end of it, he said, and you can tell me to jump in a lake. But he said, just don't do it in front of anyone else.
People ask this question of powerful women all the time, and we don't ask it often enough of powerful men. You have a wife.
Yeah.
You have children.
Yeah.
There certainly have been times when you sacrificed in your career for the service of your family, but there have been many times when your family sacrificed your presence for your career.
Yes. And that was one of the hardest things about writing this book, because I had to come to terms with the sacrifices that I inflicted on them. And ours was an unusual set of circumstances because my daughter, Lauren, my oldest child, started having seizures when she was 7 months old, and she had uncontrolled epilepsy for almost 19 years. And it was a defining struggle in our lives. She was hospitalized a lot, very hard on the two children that were born after her, very hard on my wife. And I had to I had to come to grips, and as I wrote this book, with all the times that I forced her, my wife Susan, to cope with this alone when I wasn't there for my kids. It was painful to think about, and there's no doubt that, you know, they paid a heavy price. In fact, when I was writing the book, my son, my middle son, Michael, was expecting his first child. My daughter-in-law, Liz, was pregnant. And I sent him some of these pages because he's also a pretty driven guy. And I said, don't do to your kids what I did to you. And I hope in some way that he can learn from that. And but, you know, it's funny. He said, I have a lot of to say about this, but I'm not ready to say it. So sometime we'll have that conversation. But there's no doubt that my career was costly to some degree. And it's a hard thing to come to grips with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Eddie in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. Mr. Axelrod, congratulations on two incredible campaigns.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. First of all, what would you think would the president say is the biggest mistake that he has made as president? And number two, I'm interested in wondering if you can comment on this. You know, one of the things that's very clear to at least me and most of the people I know, particularly those of us who happen to be African American, is just the unprecedented, over the top criticism, and I would even say hatred that people feel for this president, a great deal of which I believe is motivated even maybe unconsciously by race. How does he deal with that? How do he and his wife particularly deal with that privately? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Eddie, let me deal with the second part first. In the book, I talked about the fact that I never really talked about this issue of race and how much the opposition to the president was motivated by race while I was working for him, because I never wanted to imply that all the opposition was rooted in that and that there weren't legitimate differences about issues. But it is impossible to ignore that there is an element of race to the opposition. No other president has had his citizenship persistently questioned. As late as last week, you saw Mayor Giuliani questioning the president's love of country, and he said he wasn't raised like you and me. I don't know what he meant by that, but it was heavy with inference. And no other president has had someone stand up in the House of Representatives while he was speaking to the nation there and shout, "You lie." I do think that there's been an element of race in the opposition to the president. And, I suspect he knows that as well. But he's determined to be the president of the whole country. He's been sensitive to not certainly not using race as an alibi or an excuse for any failings or opposition, maybe for the same reasons I didn't raise it. But it's got to be hard. On the other hand, he's sitting there and he's president of the United States. And in his lifetime, he was born in 1961, we've gone from a situation where, as I said earlier, people were dying simply for the right to vote, to a place where he's the president of the United States. So he's aware of the progress that's been made, and that it's been made because of disciplined leaders like him pushing forward, not taking the bait, and keeping his eye on the ball. In terms of the first, his greatest mistake, you know, we used to mock President Bush when he was in office because he had a hard time finding mistakes. But I am a little more sympathetic now because you don't really think in those terms. I always say that one of our great mistakes in the years that I was there was because we were in an economic crisis, we pushed the president out there all the time, every single day, you know, to make announcements and so on. We felt it was important that people have a sense of motion. And I think that in making him sort of the announcer of the government, we made him less of a narrator of the larger story about where he wanted to lead. And, you know, that was a little bit on me and some of the folks in the White House who dealt with communications and scheduling and so on. But I think we lost our thread a little bit in those first few years. And we got it back during the campaign in 2012. But it was a mistake. And if I could do it over again, I'd maybe orchestrate some of that differently.
I'd like to talk to you about this issue of message discipline, which obviously is something near and dear to your heart. And it is important for administrations and for campaigns that everybody be on the same page. On the other hand, as a former journalist, you have to understand how maddening it can be to interview someone who sort of repeats the same 10 lines.
Yes.
Did that conflict ever occur to you? Or once you were helping to run campaigns, did you think, I can't worry about journalists trying to get the complete story and a full picture of things?
You're talking about from the standpoint of what the candidate says or what those of us who speak for the candidates say? Or
all of it. When it feels like everything is pre-scripted and everyone knows exactly what is supposed to be articulated.
Yeah, you know, it's a very fine line. I mean, first of all, there are so many ways to get off message and create stories that take you away from what you're trying to communicate. And so it forces you into that discipline. The challenge is to do that in a way that allows you still to come across authentically. And, you know, one of the things that has been a strength of the president's has been authenticity. And he himself has been resistant at times in staying on message because he wants to be authentic. This has particularly been true in the presidency. You know, we used to argue all the time because I would say we need campaign-like discipline around message, and he'd say, but this isn't the campaign. Now we're governing, and I feel like when people ask me questions, I have to give them complete answers. And so his press conference answers would run 7, 8, 9 minutes long, you know, and it would cause me to pull out my remaining hairs, you know. So it was that was a constant tug and pull. He is a very genuine guy. He is an authentic guy. And many of the sort of arguments, and we didn't have too many arguments, but many of the arguments we had were over his resistance to conforming to some of the demands of communicating in a very noisy environment, particularly when he was governing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes,
yeah,
we can.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Hey, David, I want to first tell you that I first saw you and became acquainted with you when President Obama was running for the first campaign, and I saw you speaking, and I gained a great deal of respect and admiration for you way back then. And then more recently, I read about you and your family struggle with your daughter's epilepsy in the magazine Neurology Now. I don't know if you ever saw that, and it went into some detail, and, you know, you just touched upon it a minute ago, but depth of the...
Bob, let me jump in and help you here. You were interested, I think, in asking whether David would be interested in running for office himself. Is that where we're ending up?
Ultimately, I heard that he said that he probably wasn't, but I'd be interested in hearing that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bob, that is... in part, these two points are related because I did ask a lot of sacrifice from my family. And I'm at a point in my life, I just turned 60, had my first grandchild, and I want to pay back, you know, and I want to enjoy these next years with my family more than I've ever had a chance to before. And my greatest mission, my greatest use now is to try and inspire young people to get into this arena, because there's such I think this is the most public-spirited group of young people that I've seen since the 1960s, but they don't necessarily believe politics is a valid way to deal with problems. You know, their instinct is, let's create an app, let's use social media, all of which is very powerful, but we still have to govern ourselves, and some of the decisions that are going to impact on the equities that they care deeply about, human rights and climate change, education, so on, they're all going to be impacted in a huge way by the decisions that are made in Washington and state capitals and elsewhere. So my thing is to try and encourage them. I started this Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. And, you know, I want to pass the torch on to other leaders and encourage them to run, to be advisors, to be journalists, to be in the arena. And I think that's the best use of my time moving forward.
We should be clear that you didn't just, like, hitch your wagon to a star. You had a long and storied career working with dozens of candidates over the years. Were there qualities that you learned to recognize very quickly in the ones that you would decide to work for?
You know, this is this goes back to the point I was making about the two categories of politicians. I was, as you point out, a political journalist before I went into politics. And I left journalism in 1984 in part because I saw the leading edges of what was going to happen to the newspaper business, much more emphasis on the bottom line, kind of a breakdown between the wall that used to exist between the business side and the news side that would cause me to cover things in a way that was different than I had before. So I got out of it and went into politics for a guy named Paul Simon, a congressman from Illinois, who was what I would call a believer, someone who was into politics because he thought it was a calling. And I've ever since tried to find candidates like that who were about something larger than themselves.
We're speaking this hour with David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama, founder of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, and author of the new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation in about 2 minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to former Obama senior advisor David Axelrod about his new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. How did we end up at a place where it feels like party politics is a zero-sum game, and it is so rare that anything gets bipartisan support? And it has to be that there are cases where neither side particularly has a passion for the issue at hand. They just don't want the other guys to win.
Yeah, I think this is what frustrates people so much, you know, and we're seeing it more and more. You know, when we came to office in 2009, we had this presumption, perhaps naive in retrospect, that we could forge alliances across party lines to solve problems. But I think that the other side made a strategic judgment that best to let us fend with these problems ourselves, and they could run against us on it. And that fed on itself. And they, you know, it forced the president to a position of being more partisan, which was a victory for the Republican Party. And, you know, but this has been going on for some time. I mean, it predated us getting there. We ran against it. But, You know, and there are a lot of reasons for it. One is the way, and they've been brooded about the way we elect members of Congress. All these districts now are so gerrymandered that no one ever faces a general election. They just have to worry about the most strident voices in their own party so they don't get defeated in primaries. And the rewards come for being obstreperous instead of cooperative. There's actually penalty for being cooperative. I mean, it's sort of summed up by Rush Limbaugh when the president got elected and said, I'm rooting for him to fail. Well, you know what? We only have one president at a time. We're all Americans. We ought not to be rooting for presidents to fail. But there is this sort of absolutism that's crept into our politics. We were speaking in the break about George W. Bush. Well, I've taken strong exceptions, still due to some of the policies of President Bush. But he could not have been more cordial to us and more helpful in the transition. And on the day of the inauguration, I wrote about this encounter I had with him in which he was so warm and so encouraging that I will never forget it. And we have to get to back to the point in our politics where, A, cooperation isn't a dirty word, and, B, we don't try and disqualify each other all the time as people simply because we disagree. That I can recognize that people who I disagree with strongly on issues are still people who love this country. I can honor them for being involved and giving of themselves. One of the things that I enjoy about running an Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago is, you know, on any given day, I had a day recently where I had Elena Kagan, Justice Kagan, in the morning, and I had a conversation with her in front of an audience. And then in the afternoon, Tim Phillips, who runs Americans for Prosperity, which is Koch Brothers PAC, came to talk about what they do. And I enjoyed both those conversations. They were very civil. And, you know, passionate people believe in what they're doing, obviously quite different in the pantheon of public service. But that's where we should be in our politics. We should be able to disagree without being disagreeable. And it seems like we're a long way from that now. And I have to be honest, I watch folks like your Senator Ted Cruz, who's gotten an awful lot of currency by being as sharp-edged as he could be. And like I said, the rewards are out of whack.
Do you happen to know anything about, this is a little bit off topic, but I would love to be a fly on the wall or to have planted a camera on the airplane shared by the first President Bush and President Clinton when they were traveling around doing humanitarian work together. Do you know anything at all about the relationship that developed between them?
I don't. I saw them when I was there in the Roosevelt Room filming some ads, public service ads, around their efforts in Haiti. But what I will tell you is this. Being president is such an excruciatingly hard job, and you only have a few peers. There are five living presidents, and I think what you find is that they tend to gravitate to each other. You know, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama clashed in 2008 during that campaign, Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was a kind of a acrimonious time. And by the time 2012 rolled around, we didn't have a better ally than Bill Clinton. He couldn't have been more helpful. And this was the culmination of a thawing that came because the president would call President Clinton to talk about issues and they'd sit down and they developed a relationship over time because there aren't that many folks you can turn to who totally get what being president is all about. So it doesn't surprise me that President Bush and President Clinton, who ran against each other, would end up being friends. It's also true that I think one of the characteristics of George H.W. Bush is geniality. I had a chance to cover him, and I actually met him again when Obama got elected president. I was in the Oval Office, and all the presidents were there too. The older President Bush could not have been a warmer presence. And Bill Clinton, of course, is an affable person. So I'm not terribly surprised by that. But it is an interesting thing and a heartening thing that they have the relationship that they have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ben in DeSoto. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, in light of how a president's legacy changes over time and how President Clinton, President Bush, both Bushes, how their legacies have developed and changed, what, Mr. Axelrod, what you think of what President Obama's legacy is this day, today, and how it's going to develop over time?
Well, you know, it's very hard to judge a president's legacy in real time, you know, especially given the kind of echo chamber of Washington, which focuses very much on polls and who's up and who's down and so on. But I feel that history is going to record that he was the president who led the country through an epic economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, who made a series of decisions, each of which was as unpopular as they were necessary, including to save the American auto industry, but the Recovery Act and shoring up the financial system. He'll be remembered as someone who took on the health care issue and prevailed after seven presidents had tried and seven presidents had failed. He'll be remembered as a guy who wound down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yes, we know that that's an ongoing challenge in that region. But we had 180,000 troops on the ground in those countries when he came, in just 15,000 today. He'll be remembered as a president who presided over real changes in how gay and lesbian Americans are treated under the law. There are a series of things that I think will be part of his legacy that add up to real important fundamental change, and they can be measured in the lives of auto workers who are still on the line, service people who are home instead of halfway across the world risking their lives in civil wars. They'll be measured in terms of people who have health care. Everywhere I go, I run into people who say that law saved my life. And I myself am very much attuned to that because I had a child, as I said, who was quite ill. And my family almost went bankrupt because of what our insurance wouldn't cover when she was young. And I always talk about the fact that when the health care bill passed, the night it passed, I went into my office and I sobbed. And I was really surprised myself, and I realized I was crying because I realized that people wouldn't have to go through, families wouldn't have to go through the kind of trauma that we went through, financial trauma, because of what we had accomplished. I went and found the president, and I said, thank you for on behalf of all the families who won't have to suffer the kinds of problems that my family did. And he put his hand on my shoulder and said, that's why we do the work. And That always will stick with me because it reminded me why we do the work. We do the work to try and have a real tangible impact now and in the future. I think he'll be remembered as a president who did that.
Is the Affordable Care Act, as it exists today, the best possible health care law, or was it simply the only health care law that you could get passed?
It's the best possible law that we could get passed. I don't think anybody would argue that this is the system that you would construct if you started from scratch. But it is, you know, when before that law was passed, we had gone through a decade of near double-digit health care inflation. We had millions more people without health insurance every year. And it would have continued in that way if we hadn't acted. And there are a whole range of protections that people have under health care today that they didn't have before. No more lifetime caps, no ban on people with pre-existing conditions, children up to 26 on their parents' insurance, rebates if the insurance company spends your premiums, most of your premiums, on things other than healthcare. You know, a whole range of things that are better today because of it. So, is it the perfect system? No. Will there be changes and adaptations over time? I'm sure there will. But are we much better off than we were before it passed? I believe so. And I think most of the medical professionals you talk to would agree with that.
Do you imagine the president will endorse Hillary Clinton's apparent campaign for the presidency?
Well, I don't think he'll endorse her apparent campaign. But if it becomes a real campaign, at some point, you know, I believe she's going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. I have a lot of respect for everybody else who's running. Elizabeth Warren is a good friend of mine, but I think it's pretty clear that if Hillary runs, that she's likely to be the nominee of the party. And yes, I think he'll endorse her if that's the case. And she is. She is someone with whom he has worked really closely. I mean, you know, one of the great stories about the administration, I was not sure when he said he wanted to appoint her Secretary of State. We'd just gone through this pitched battle, and I thought, well, how's this going to work? And it turned out that they had a really good relationship, very respectful. She's a very serious person, a serious public servant, and they share a lot of sensibilities about the future of the country, particularly how we build an economy that works for large numbers of people and not just a small number of people, and that makes opportunity not a closely held asset. So I believe that he'll support her if she's the nominee. Now, you know, Vice President Biden hasn't spoken, and he's very close to him yet as to what his plans are. So I don't see the president making a precipitous decision. He'll let the process work. But, I'm sure if she's the nominee, he'll be supportive.
Is she the best possible nominee, or is it her turn?
I don't think it's a matter of If her message is that it's her turn, it's not a good message.
And I'm not asking if it's her message.
No. I think that she is probably in many ways as experienced as anybody who's run. And I think that it's now incumbent on her to say what her vision for the future is. And that's the test that she's going to have to meet. I've said in 2007 she was not a very good candidate because she was cloistered in this presumption of inevitability. Her candidacy got out in front of the rationale for it. And only after she lost the Iowa caucuses did she throw that caution off and really connect with people, I think, in a very authentic way, visceral way, showed her own vulnerabilities and struggles, identified with theirs. And she laid out a vision, an economic vision that people could connect to. If she is that candidate, she would be the best candidate and the best potential president. But that is the burden is on her now to show that she can be that candidate and that president.
How often in your work now at the Institute of Politics do you meet a young person and think, this is a person worth watching?
You know, more than you'd imagine. The University of Chicago is an extraordinary place, and these kids are very talented who come there. But every single time I go down there, I'm inspired by some young person I meet. They're serious, they're focused, and, you know, they've got a lot of academic work to do. Mine is an extracurricular program, and they spend hours and hours. One of the most impressive things about it is they've started their own programs, a tech team, to help community organizations and small not-for-profits upgrade their tech capacity so they can help more people and have a greater impact. And things like that just make me so optimistic about the future. These kids are committed, and I want to encourage them.
David Axelrod is former senior advisor to President Obama and author of the new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, I so appreciate you making time for us.
Oh, it's fun to be here. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.